Okay, today is March 23rd, 2013, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Pete Mary at his home here in Fairbanks, and we're going to be talking about Gnarl and his experiences as a pilot for Wien Airlines and based in and out of Barrow. So thank you, Pete, for taking the time. We've had a little bit of back and forth in trying to get this scheduled, so yeah, I appreciate yeah. it. So just to get us started, and tell me a little bit about where you come from, when you were born, where you're growing up.
Well, I was born in Oregon on February 17th, 1930. My mother was born in London on February 17th, 1899. Oh. And my father was born in Johannesburg. Got gassed in the Canadian Army at Ypres in the Canadian Field Artillery and was in a hospital in London. And my mother went to see her brother, who was my dad's friend. Uh-huh. And
that's how they met.
That's how they met.
And then, do you have siblings?
I have four children. We had, Renee and I had four daughters.
So you have, you have brothers and sisters.
I had two older sisters and one of them is alive.
Okay.
My sister Mady is still alive.
So how did your parents get from London to Oregon?
They, after the war, they went to Newfoundland, and Uncle Ted had been living in Toronto. They went to Toronto for a while, and they went to up in the Kootenay area, just inside of Canada, just above Grand Coulee Dam. And if they could have held on to that land, they would have been very rich orchard people later years, but they couldn't do it. And they went to Vancouver. My dad was a carpenter, and he worked there. And then they came to Seattle, and they liked Seattle. But then during the Depression, they went to Oregon. And in 1934, they decided that they would go back to Seattle. So that's where they went back to mm-hmm. Seattle, and my father would get work in the summertime for maybe three and a half months. My mother, about 1936, started sewing leather coats for Seattle Woolen Mills, and she was really the breadwinner of the house. Mm. And
so your father was a carpenter, was the kind of work he did?
Yes.
Okay. Sounds like he was pretty important to you.
What's that?
Was your father pretty important figure in your life?
My mother was.
Your mother? I can tell you got a little emotional, so I can tell they were important to you. So you grew up in Seattle?
Yes.
Then. Okay. And you went through high school there?
Yes.
Your educational?
And I went to Seattle U for about almost 2 years as a chemist, but I was bitten by flying airplanes.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, I started during the Second World War. All airplanes, light airplanes on the West Coast, had to be either flown east of the Cascade Mountains, had to be 300 miles inland, or you had to take the engine and the wings off the airplanes. Hmm. So there was Kurtzer, who had a training school on Lake Union. He went to Yakima and trained military pilots. And then once the airplanes were allowed back on the West Coast, which was in the summer of 1946, why, Kurtzer opened up his operation again, and I started taking pilot training. And it cost me $18 for 30 minutes. And even though I had jobs, I wasn't making a lot of money, so it took me. So finally, a friend of mine that I had met, who was a pilot for West Coast Airlines and was also an instructor, Joe Brosi, he said to me, he said, "Peter," he said, you're just keeping up. So what I want you to do is save up your money until you can take 3 hours of flight training." So I saved up my money, and my mother helped me a little. And when I had 3 hours, I went in and started taking the training, and I soloed. And that was on the 22nd of January 1957, and I wasn't 17 until that next month. And I got my private license that summer on the 22nd of July.
Mm-hmm. So did you have to take flight school first and then you got to go out and fly? Or it was all combined?
It was all combined. There'd be a little talking session ahead of time what we're going to do, you know, but nothing like in today's world.
Yeah.
So then I flew as a private pilot a little, you know, and accumulated a fair amount of time. I probably had 500 hours, and then during the Korean War, I was in a reserve outfit, and we got activated. I just came back from Southeastern, and we got activated, and we were in the service for 21 months, and when we got discharged, I used my Korean Bureau GI Bill, which I had to pay 25% to get my instrument rating in my multi-engine C and to finish up my commercial. And
so were you in the Air Force then in the Korean War?
Yes, I was in the Air Force. Air Base Group, 73rd Air Base Group. And then I came back to Seattle, and I got hired by Northwest and sent to Minneapolis and went to co-pilot school there on the DC-3 and the C-54 and DC-4. And right when I was finishing this, the 6 weeks of training, they lost the Korean airlift contract with the military, and I got furloughed, and I was the youngest man in the last class they chained, and there was 169 co-pilots ahead of me, so it was going to be a while before I was going to get called. And I went back and worked for Northwest as a baggage handler for a little bit, and ATA called me up, Bernasconi called me up and said he wants me to fly co-pilot in C-46s, so.
And that was AGA?
ATA, Air Transport Associates.
Oh, okay.
They were not SCET. Okay. We were flying CAMs, which were civil air movements. We were flying soldiers back and forth across the United States, coming and going to Korea.
Okay.
Because the war was still going on in Korea.
Okay.
And then they wrecked an airplane after a couple of months. And then I came back to Seattle and I got hired by Johnson Flying Service to fly co-pilot on their DC-3, C-47. And that winter, I was having a tough time with one of the second captain, and so I just thought it would be best that I just quit, and then I went back to Southeast Alaska that next spring, and fished with Richard Hofstede, who I'd fished with before, and his only daughter was married to Bud Boding, who was the chief pilot for Ellis Airlines. And I called Bud up and I asked, because I'd met Bud, and asked him if they had anything that I could do. And he said, I don't, but he called up Shell Simmons and at Alaska Coastal, and Shell hired me. So I worked for them for a couple of years. I met Renee when I was flying for Coastal in Lockheed Vega on floats. And they bought a helicopter and they hired a guy that was just getting out of the military, and his name was Sweeney, and he just inserted him in this seniority list ahead of me, and it made me mad. So I had a letter from two letters from Sassin, who was an old-time bush pilot in Southeastern, and one of them was to Bill Borland, whose dad got killed with Carl Van Ilsen at East Cape Siberia. Mm-hmm. And he was the chief pilot for Reeve. And I presented the letter to him, and then he read it, and he sent me over to see Bob Reeve, and Bob Reeve hired me, and I said I'd have to go back to Coastal and give him 2 weeks' notice. So I came up to Fairbanks, because Renee was up here, and ran into Jim McGoffin on the street at Interior Airways, and I'd flown a widgeon for him, and he offered me a lot more money and room and board and at Barrow. So he wanted me to fly primarily to fly a Norseman on floats, but it was April, there was no water at Barrow at that time. And I was flying co-pilot on the DC-3s and on the C-46 and flying 180s, and didn't really have anything to do with with NARL at that time. That was in 1956.
Yeah, that was my question. When you came to Fairbanks, that was 1956?
Yeah, 1956. So they hired Jim McGoffin, had a couple of Yupik boys that were mechanics for him. And I was in Barter Island with 725 Easy, a Norseman on floats, and it needed a 100 hour. And here come Mickey McDougall and Joe Pete Jr. And the first thing they did is cut the safety wire and let the 20 gallons of oil in the tank run into the lagoon. And that was perfectly the normal thing that done at that in 1956. They got the 100 hour done, and guess what? They didn't have any oil to pour back in it.
Uh-oh.
All they had to do was clean the screens. They didn't have to change the oil.
Or pour it into something.
Yeah, or pour it into something. So anyway, I came to town and took that letter to George Rayburn, who was the chief controller of Ween Airlines, and he sent me over to Dick King, and Dick King hired me on the 1st of August of 1956, and I flew for them for the next 30 years. But I was flying co-pilot, and one of the co-pilots, Joe Cross, wasn't real experienced, and he was flying with, I think, Red Kurtz, and they were taxiing down to the south end of the runway, and they had the tailwheel locked, and Red had said, unlock the tailwheel, and Joe lifted the landing gear. And there was a new engine on the right side and a 1,000-hour engine on the left side, and there's a rod that goes down the holes the gear. When the gear is compressed, that rod is supposed to go through that hole and stop the gear from retracting. And there was ice built up on it. And guess what? The left gear came up, and of course it wrecked that new engine and did damage to the wing, so they took some time to fix it, and I got furloughed. And so I went up and flew for Jim McGoffin out of Barter Island during the time I was furloughed, and flew Norseman for him. And came back, and I had been talking to Don Holshizer, and Holshizer wanted to fly it on mainline, and he had a much higher seniority number than me, and so I traded with him. And part of the deal was that I would go to Barrow and fly the village bush pilot out of Barrow. So that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And
so I want to step back a second. With Jim McGoffin and Interior Airlines, what kind of flying was that? Was that commuter flying, or what was he doing flying around all over?
We were building the Dew Line.
Oh, okay.
And on primarily, you were hauling people, you were hauling food, supplies, all sorts of stuff like that.
Okay, so you were flying from Fairbanks to Barter Island to Cape Simpson to
I did a bunch of that for Weens.
Okay.
But I did the C-46 Jim McGoffin had. I made trips back and forth from Barrow to Fairbanks to Point Lay, or, you know, to different Bar 1 in the fog.
Bar 1 being Barrow 1, the Dew Line.
Yeah, the
station.
Dew Line,
right.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, but other people might not. I can't remember all the different...
Well, there was the main sites Palmain, Lonely, Aluktuk Point, Flaxman Island, Barter Island, and then there was the I sites, which were, which was Pow B A and a C and a D.
Oh,
yeah.
I only heard it. And Cape Simpson was one of them.
Yeah, Cape Simpson was one of them.
I don't remember its thing. Anyway, that's off the subject, sort of. This is an aside, but can you explain the difference between a C-46 and a DC-3?
Well, it's two completely different airplanes. One of them, the DC-3, has Pratt & Whitney 1830 engines on it. The ones that I flew generally had 92s or 94. Dash 92s or 94, and they're around 1,400 horsepower. And a C-46 has got has B engines on it, or it had B engines with C cylinders, And that airplane, it makes that engine with the C cylinders makes 1960 horsepower in ISA conditions at sea level. That means the temperature is 57 degrees, mm-hmm. 15 degrees Celsius. The barometric pressure is 2992, you're at sea level. And at 60 miles an hour, the engine is making 1960 horsepower. It's not making its full power initially when you went brake release. You have to get it moving before mm-hmm. it makes its full horsepower.
But were C-46 is what the military used?
Yes.
And then DC-3s came later?
No, DC-3s, the military used them too.
Oh. Because I've heard them used almost interchangeably, like they're the same plane, but they're not.
They're not, no. The C-46 is a much bigger airplane.
Okay.
It holds about 12,500 pounds of cargo, where a DC-3 or a C-47 under ideal conditions will haul 6,500 pounds.
Maybe that's the DC-3, C-47. They're the same plane.
Yes, they're the same airplane.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
They're the same airplane. And there was no civilian model of a C-46 ever built. There was our models, which was Riddle conversions, which was legal to haul passengers in. Mm-hmm. And when we converted two of our airplanes to Supers, which had a different exhaust system on them, and you could haul passengers on them too.
So anybody who flew C-46s, civilian, that was an old military plane that was surplus and the company bought it?
Yes.
Or they leased it or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's what Jim McGoffin did, and that's, and his DC-3s were probably C-47s too,
yeah.
You know.
Because also Cliff Everts, wasn't he also flying mm-hmm. those types of planes?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've heard them that in Alaska they were used, and I wasn't
yeah.
clear on
still,
the difference.
Still flying some C-40. Cliff is still flying some C-46s.
Wow. Yeah. They still work, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, so you were sort of doing a lot of flying here, there, and everywhere
mm-hmm.
Before you started flying for Wien. So
yes.
When did you first go up to Barrow then?
When I went to Barrow was in June of 57. That's when I got based at Barrow.
But you'd been flying in and out of there before that?
Yes, I flew out of there for Jim McGoffin.
Okay.
And then I'd been flying there on the Dew Line, you know, with hauling supplies up there too.
Mm-hmm. So what was Barrow like back then?
About 1,200 people. A lot of people had dogs, which they treated very, very badly. And there was no natural gas. The cabins were cold. The cabin that the company had rented for me was built by Lee Suvalu. It was his place, and it was built in 1930. And it had Celotex for insulation in the walls, and that was all. And you had to, in the wintertime, you wore your mukluks on because the floor was always freezing.
Mm-hmm. What's Celotex?
It's just kind of like a fiberboard.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so how was it heated? Because they don't have...
We heated it with a oil cook stove.
Okay. Like fuel oil?
Fuel oil, yes. Yeah. The number one diesel, that was kind of blue, and it would congeal a little when it got cold. If it got 50 below, it didn't run very good. It got syrupy.
Yeah.
So after I got to Barrow, well, then they started, NARL started, they didn't have airplanes yet.
In 1957, they didn't have airplanes
they
yet?
They didn't have airplanes yet. They didn't get airplanes until 58. And... So I remember taking, we called him Judge Salzman. He'd worked for NARL, and he also worked as a part-time magistrate in Barrow before Sadie kind of mm-hmm. got involved in it. Sadie
yeah.
Brower, or
yeah.
What,
yeah. yeah.
She was my wife's buddy.
Uh-huh. What did he do at NARL?
Well, I took him to Umiat, and the drilling heads, you know, the drill bits
mm-hmm.
were Hughes Tool and Die Company would not sell you a bit. Hmm. They would lease you that bit. And the bits were all numbered.
Oh.
And somehow or other, in just while the Navy was still drilling out of Umiat, a bunch of drill bits got missing. And Salzman was able to take a weasel, which was a tracked vehicle, go out an old trail up on top of the hill, and somebody had just thrown the bits out of the back of the...
Wow.
And he was able to retrieve them.
Oh.
And of course, I always get a kick out of the story about Howard Hughes' dad and being hauled into court in Texas because the Wildcatters were suing him because him and his partner would not sell these drill bits.
Oh.
And the judge said to Howard Hughes' dad, "Don't you think it's awfully unfair not to sell these bits to the Wildcatters?" And he said, "They can use shovels."
So at that point, he must have been working for the Navy then.
I think he was still working for the Navy.
Yeah. And at the moment, I can't quite remember when the Navy pulled out. And when sort of, because once the Navy pulled out of their oral exploration, then it became ARL. And
well, the Navy quit in the late 40s, and Arctic Contractors came in.
Right. Was that 46 when?
46 or 47.
Yeah.
And then Arctic Contractors were very active up until about 52. In fact, they say at Kialik, which is back behind Wainwright, about 50 miles, there's three rivers, and one of them is called the Kialik, and they had a site there, and it was just before Christmas, and they said when the Norsemen came in to pick up the last people that were there, they didn't even turn the generator off. They just got in the Norsemen and left.
That was the Navy leaving, or that Arctic was Contractors?
Arctic Contractors.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, Arctic Contractors ran the camp. I used to know this history off the top of my head, and I'm a little sketchy on it now, because then it became more of a science facility, not an oil exploration camp. And then the university kind of was running it. But I don't remember the dates anymore.
And I remember being at Umiat when Bobby Fischer brought these two people in, and one of them was a great big Englishman, and he had a pissy hat on, and he had a great big net, and he went running out in the field with his short pants and his great big net, and he came back 20 minutes or so later, and he was very dejected. It was a such and such and such and such a kind of bug, and it escaped. And he was not very happy. But I took people out to, charters out like to Teshapuk Lake, and they were looking at picking up samples of the different plants on the ground and stuff like that. And then I was called in to see Max and John Schindler, and they introduced me to Henry Childs, and he was getting his doctorate. And this was in 1957. He was getting his doctorate in zoology. And they wanted me to take him to the Pitmegea River and land at the mouth, which is about 50 miles up the beach from Cape Lisburg. It's quite a ways, two-thirds of the way to Point Hope from Barrow. And about another 125 miles south of Point Lay, south and a little bit west. And I was Forrest Solomon Jr. was with them, and he was about 16 years old. And I was to drop most of their camp off, and they were to take their boat and a few days of food and their weapons and stuff. And I was to take them up to Pitmegea and land them as far as up I could. And I got a little overzealous, I think, because when I landed right in a creek, and just barely got stopped. And then when I took off, I taxied back in the creek and laid the whip to it and got out of there okay. And I got to Barrow, and went in to eat my lunch, and I came back out, and then the tire was sticking right through the side of, the tube was sticking right through the side of the tire on my left main, before I had tapped a rock in
the creek. You hit a rock with it, huh?
Yeah. But it got me home.
Well, that's good.
And Henry Forrest Jr. said that they pulled that raft for 3 days before they got to water enough that they could float it. So, but he got back at me because I went down there two or three different other times in order to bring him food, and because they were down there for 5 or 6 weeks, I think. And bring back specimens, and boy, some of those specimens I took back, brought back, were really, really rotten and really stinky in the airplane. So I think he was getting back at me for making him walk and pull that raft for 3 days.
At this point, you're working for Ween Airlines, and they had the contract with.
Well, they're just chartered. They were just chartered.
Right, they hired them as charter flights.
Yeah, charter flights.
Okay.
And I went over to. I guess I went to. No. I had a charter, I guess, to Peters Lake too, and I was some kind of ichthyologist, and that's when the guy told me that 35, 40-pound fish is probably 70, 80 years old.
Wow, those would be lake trout?
Yes, big lake trout. They're very slow growing because they don't have, the season isn't open very long on those lakes, to get bugs in.
No.
It's a very short season.
Yeah, well, they're kind of like black spruce trees. They grow really slowly, and so they're small but old or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, The big deal was after they got their airplanes, they were kind of in 58, they kind of took care of themselves. There was Bobby Fischer went to work for ARL, and so did Zimmerman, and I hired Frank Gregory at Ween's. So Frank came, I'd flown with him at Interiors, and and it was, I lived in our house, and Renee was pregnant with Margie. And it was about the 11th or so of February. And when we went to bed at night, it was dark. And when the oil burned in the stove, there was a little crack, and it always reflected on the ceiling. And I woke up, and I heard snap, crack, the water in the 55-gallon galvanized drums was starting to freeze back up.
Uh-oh.
The oil had gotten dirt in it on the outside and plugged up and quit. And my sister, Mady, had given us an electric blanket. And we were underneath that electric blanket. When I stuck my arm out, it's 25 below in that cabin. I jumped up and threw my clothes on as quick as I could and got Renee's clothes on. She got up and got dressed quick, and we had an electric coffee maker and an electric frying pan and an electric toaster, and we made breakfast, and it almost froze when you put it on the plates. And got her up to the Ween radio shack. Of course, Ween's was communicating with SAS and people flying over the pole at that time, with great big HF radios in a radio shack, and it was always warm up there. And then the flight came in, and Renee went back, came to town, and stayed with Norm Maturek for a few days. But Lee Staley came over, and that evening, and we figured out what was wrong with my oil stove that afternoon when I was through flying and got the oil stove going. There was a bunch of dirt on the outside, and we got it cleaned out and got the oil stove going again. And that next day, Bobby Fischer stopped by and said that Max Brewer and John Schindler want to see you. And I knew that, I didn't know that the company was negotiating a contract with NARL to fly supplies in a DC-4 to RLS-1 and then later RLS-2, and actually went in and out of T-3 to some extent too. And So I went down, when I could, I went out and saw Max and John Schindler, and They wanted me to, Zimmerman was in Menlo Park, California, mm-hmm. getting a R4D, which is a Navy version of a C-47 or DC-3.
Okay.
But it's got flush riveted, it's quite a bit faster, and it's got bigger engines. It's got Wright 101s, which are 1,500 horsepower.
So that was Norwell starting to get their own planes.
Yeah, they were going to get their own big multi-engine plane. So, there was just Bobby. They wanted to take two airplanes, and they wanted to know if I could go. So I went, and I called Dick King and told him the situation. And he said, "You'll have to talk to Sigurd Ween."
Right.
And I knew the contract said that I could only fly for Ween Airlines unless I get prior permission. And I didn't know that they were negotiating this contract with ARL at the time. So Sigurd Ween, he never called me Peter. He always called me Mary. it was just the way Sig was, but that's fine. But he said to me, he said, "Peter," he said, "Mary, you've got to be completely caught up. I don't mind you doing it, but you can't have any extra sections that need flying or anything like that." So, and I'd been pretty good at keeping caught up anyway. I didn't like to get behind. And so that was on a Friday, and Saturday I made my extra section, a couple of extra sections to Wainwright. And Monday I made my schedule and to Wainwright. Then I called Bobby Fisher up and I said, this is the 14th of February. I said, "I've got this one more trip to make to Wainwright, and I'm caught up. How does tomorrow look for weather?" And Bobby said, "It looks pretty good as far as I can see." So I did the schedule, and Bobby picked me up. And Arliss 1 was 346 nautical miles north-northwest of Point Barrow, almost going towards the North Pole. And that's a long way out there. It's a single-engine airplane.
Yeah.
And so we took off about 8 o'clock in the morning.
So at this point, were you using a Ween plane?
I was using an Arliss airplane,
okay.
Yes. And it was one of their airplanes. And I found right off the bat that the ADF didn't work. And then my HF radio was acting up. So all I had communications was my VHF with Bobby. So I had to stay with Bobby. You know, I couldn't lose him. So
he was in a separate plane?
Yeah, another 180.
Oh, you were both in 180s, okay.
Yeah, on 180s on skis. And so we went out at about 1,000 feet, and it took us a little over 3 hours. We had a little bit of a headwind. And we got on the ground on Arliss 1, and I poured in my 9 5-gallon cans of gas, and it just almost filled me up. And they put in a big chunk of Arliss sea ice, probably 350, 400 pound chunk of ice that they wanted to check for tensile strength in barrel at NARO lab. And Bobby, I think, had a couple of passengers. And we took off, and we flew about 20 minutes. And we started got into some freezing rain, and it was piling up fast on the airplanes. And I told Bobby, I said, "We can't stay here, we're gonna fall out of the sky." And Bobby says, "Let's go on top." So I just tucked in on his, to the right of him, where I could look out my right window and see him, and just followed him through the, and we broke out on top at about 4,500 feet in the clear. And both of the airplanes, the oil temperature was real hot. We didn't have shutters like we did at Ween airplanes. And we had a lot of ice on the airplanes too, so we were kind of slow to begin with. But I knew in that clear air that it was just a matter of time that ice was all gonna sublimate, it was just gonna evaporate off the airplane, which it did. And about the time it was just really starting to get dark, I looked down and I could start seeing ice below me. So we'd ran off of the undercast, the clouds underneath us, we'd ran off of them. And then I looked way out in the distance and I could see that big tower of barrel with the lights, all the four cables with lights on. And it really kind of looked like Chicago to me out there. I was very happy to see that. I came in and it was dark, and Max gave me 3 barrels of of 8087 Avgas, which I used to chase polar bears on the ice with.
That was your payment for
payment for the trip.
Yeah, that runway didn't have lights, did it?
Yes, it did.
The Narl runway had lights?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
The Pierce Blanking runway.
Okay. Yeah, the one that...
Marston Matt.
Right. That it's not the runway that's currently used in Barrow, but
no,
at the time, it's the one that runs along parallel
along the beach,
to the ocean.
Yeah.
Right.
The other side of the camp.
Yeah.
And I was up to Barrow here winter before last in January, and Debbie Schontz was still in the administration up there, and she took me around, took me and Diana, my youngest daughter. We went around and went to the old camps and stuff and saw old Hut 144 where I used to stay at when I flew for Interior. But pretty kind of dilapidated out there now.
Yeah, they've refurbished part of it for the college and then other parts they haven't used. So I want to go back a little bit and ask you a few things before we move on to some other, I'm sure, great adventure stories, all that flying. But just to clarify a few things. So, do you remember Zimmerman's first name?
Bob Zimmerman, I think. Robert Zimmerman. We called him, everybody called him Beach Ball.
Beach Ball? Why?
Well, I don't know.
So was Bobby Fischer the chief pilot for Narl? Did they have a chief pilot?
I think he was the chief pilot.
Okay.
At that time.
At that time. And so then I'm curious about your living situation because, so you were working for Ween, and so you and Renee, your wife, family moved up there. And you lived in a house that was provided by Ween?
Yes.
Okay, and you lived in town in Barrow?
In Barrow.
Okay.
Not in Browerville. We lived in Barrow.
Right. You lived near the airport, probably.
I took off. The airport
wasn't... Oh, the airport wasn't there.
Airport wasn't there.
So
I used the sandbar between on the beach there, that spit. I used that quite...
Along the lagoon there.
Along the lagoon. And then I operated on wheel skis or straight skis in the wintertime.
Okay.
And they hadn't built the dam, so the lagoon went way back.
Right, so that was what people used. So you were flying Norsemans in 180s?
180s,
yeah. Yeah. So
Beavers.
So it wasn't big planes?
No.
And you were, for Ween, you were flying people out to the villages and supplies and things?
Yeah. Okay. And some charters.
Okay.
I went out to Avialavik a few times, picking up fish, and went out to Woods's quite a few different times.
On the mouth of the Colville
there.
Yes,
on the west fork, yeah.
Right, okay. Because it's interesting that you lived in town, whereas the people who worked for Narl, they all lived out at camp.
Yeah, when I flew for Jim McGoffin, we lived in Hut 144.
And when you flew for Jim McGoffin and you lived out there, did you interact with people in town at all?
A little bit, but not very much. A little bit, but not very, very.
Were there rules that said you could or couldn't, or was...
No, there was no rules, but it was difficult. When the wind blew, it drifted the roads. You know, you could get stuck real easy if you used the company's equipment, and so you tended to stay out at the base, you know.
And you had all your food and everything at the base. So even though you were working for McGoffin and Interior Air, you still could stay on the base and eat there
and
all that?
Yes, yeah. That was all provided.
We were
building the Dew Line, and that was our function, was to supply support to the Dew Line.
Right, and so it was Navy and Dew Line, so that makes sense. Yeah. So when you lived in town with your wife, what was that like?
Well, poor Renee, she grew up on the Yukon River at Rampart, but did a lot of her time at boarding school. And when we got married in 1958, on August the 6th of 58, I was based at Barrow, but I flew for two summers. I flew strictly on floats for Mobile Oil, just strictly charters for supporting a geology camp and a helicopter. And we moved the north side and the south side of the Brooks Range. We did from Bettles to the Canadian border, I mean to Demarc Bay, and out towards Arctic Village and through that country in the summer of 58 and the 59, we went from Bettles across to the upper part of the Kobuk and the Selawik, and then we went north to a place called Epowick Lake, and I was getting supplies out of Point Hope for then, and I would come to town about twice a week to Kotzebue or and pick up supplies, you know, but come into, if they could come into Barrow, I would go to Barrow and get them, and so
that was the first summer you were married?
Yeah, we got married, and then of course then we went to Barrow in October of 58, and it was pretty big shock for Renee. She'd gone to school with some girls that she knew, people that were Wien radio operators that were, but she knew Elfrieda Lord, and she knew Molly Avakana.
Who's now Molly Peterson.
What?
She's now Molly Peterson.
Oh, is she?
I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, and she didn't know Emily, Amelia Pollock. Yeah. She was working as a radio operator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, how was it for you and your wife to integrate into the community?
Well, that seemed to be okay, you know. Walton Amawick's wife, Cynthia Amawick, she's made the statement, I hear you're Athabascan. And Renee said, yes, I'm Athabascan. And she said, normally I don't like Athabascans, but if you're Pete Mary's wife, I guess she'll do. She was a blood old girl.
That's funny, because non-natives don't always have such an easy time being accepted in a native community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it sounds like you were accepted.
When I flew for the native people, I treated them just like anybody else, you know, and I went out of my way to accomplish the things that they wanted done. They could see that right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tell if your guy was wants to help them or not. You know,
right?
Sure, I wanted the money. You know, but you had the job to do too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just wondering what in that time period what race relations were like in Barrow. You know, how the different cultural groups got along.
I always at that time I sensed that there was if an Eskimo girl was going with a black person, she was kind of looked down at in the community. Yeah, I think that was that was the case.
But if it was with a white person, that was okay.
That was seemed to be that was okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always thought that that time period. For Barrow, all of a sudden they had Dew Line and they had the Navy at Narl, and there's a lot of outsiders coming in and short timers, sort of too, and not necessarily people who lived in town and like you guys did. And so I've always wondered how that all mixed or didn't mix.
Well, one of the things that I had been there after that summer of 57, Mara Agayak and her husband, they moved their house from Browerville just across the street from where the house was. We call it 21 Beach Drive, and their house was right across the street. And she was very superstitious that there was a sailor buried underneath our house. She went to say there's lights come on at night, and she would kind of really watch after Renee when I was gone out of town, you know. She had that right off the bat.
Uh-huh.
You know, kind of somebody acting like a second mother.
Yeah, somebody to watch over you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I find in having lived in Barrow, is that, yeah, you make a few close friends, and then that helps.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have an in, not an in, but you know, yeah, you have your
Al Hobson always seems to like me pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I liked Forrest Solomon. He was...
And were there ever language barriers?
No, not really. You had to kind of get used to the way they talked, you mm-hmm. know.
They spoke English well enough by that point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, but they had some sayings. I'm trying to think of one of them now. There was a couple of sayings that Forrest had that was just, in a positive and then in a negative, you know. Mm-hmm.
When I was thinking, even when you lived at Hut 144 by yourself and you were going over to, you know, the main building for meals, mm-hmm. did the natives and the non-natives interact? I don't even know how many natives were even working there at that point.
Well, most of the people, the natives got on the man lift, which was pulled by a dozer, and it was just like a big house with bunks in it, maybe 16, 18 feet wide and maybe 30 feet long, and it showed up at the base before 8 o'clock every morning, and then when the shift was over at 5 o'clock, it went back to the village. Okay. So the native people were eating their lunches there, but they weren't staying on the base. They were living in the village.
Right. But that's say at lunchtime you'd interact, and were you know did people interact or is it the new pack on one side of the room and the white guys on the other?
To some extent, but there was certainly there was no hostilities to my knowledge.
Yeah. Because the man lift made me think at that time the road wasn't there. That was the only way to get back and forth.
Yeah, and they had trucks with great big tires on them, you know.
Yeah.
Tundra tires and stuff like
that. And were
there
times when they couldn't get one way or the other?
If it would really get stormy, You know, a barrel can get pretty wild.
I know, yeah. Especially back then when there was no road, I can imagine.
And, of course, the village was coal, like I said, and it wasn't until 1961 that they got natural gas in the village.
But there was gas at Gnarl before then.
Yes.
Right. So when you and Renee lived in town, now you were working for Ween, mm-hmm. but you were flying out of the lagoon. So how did you get back and forth to the base? I guess would be my question.
I would get on the Ween truck going out to meet the C-46s or F-27 to get mail.
Okay, so Ween had its own truck. Mm-hmm. It wasn't part of the Gnarl man lift.
No, it was. In fact, they were still flying C-46s when I was going. Yeah, they had their own truck, you know.
Okay, I want to know more about this flying to the ice islands. Did when you flew out there, that wasn't the first flight.
No, mm-hmm. no. But it was just shortly after that Ween's leased the DC-4 and started flying routine flights about twice a week. And they did that for, that went on for two and a half, three years. And Don Gilbertson and Bud Hagberg, who was vice president for Ween's. They bought a 749 Connie that had been a KLM Royal Dutch passenger airplane that had flown between Amsterdam and Buenos Aires most of its life, in its 10 years of life. And we got reading, they were going to use that airplane on Ice Island, and they got reading the paperwork on it. And those wheels were set on a 12-degree angle or 12.5-degree angle. And the maximum amount of snow or slush that you could handle with that airplane, with that front tire, was an inch. There was no way in the world that
not
they
on
could...
on an ice island, that's not going to work.
There was no way that you could go to the ice island with that airplane.
So what kind of planes did you use?
Well, we were using a DC-4.
DC-4.
That they leased from Alaska Airlines.
No, Ween Airlines.
No, Ween Airlines.
Yeah.
That's what I was flying
yeah.
for.
Yeah. Don't get Alaska Airlines in the end. Confuse me.
Well, Alaska, that's where Ween's leased the airplane, though, from.
Oh, they leased. Alaska Airlines already existed at that point.
Alaska Airlines had the airplane, and they leased it to Ween. Ween.
And then Ween had the contract to fly that plane.
Yes.
For ARL.
Yes.
Okay. And so two times a week, was that out to Arliss 1?
Arliss 1 and then to Arliss 2.
So what was being flown out there so often?
Seems lots of people and stuff. Maybe there was only, sometimes it was only, we go once a week, mm-hmm. you know.
But that's a big plane to land out on an ice island. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
That must have been exciting.
Yeah. I never went myself, but, Tommy Richards and Billy English and those guys.
Oh, Billy English flew out there. I didn't know that.
And, of course, T1 and T2, and they're all chunks of the Ellesmere Island mm-hmm. Glacial ice, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when they break off, they're like 200 feet thick initially. You know?
Right.
It's very, very thick
right.
glacier ice. It's very, very hard and packed.
Except in the springtime.
Well, yeah, it gets soft in the springtime.
It gets soft in the springtime. I've seen pictures of the buildings up on pedestals because it all melted around.
Yeah, there was an Air Force C-47 out there on a T-3 mm-hmm. that when T-3 was about 90 miles north of Barrow in around 68, when we were still could hunt polar bears. Mm-hmm. I know Cleo McMahon and I flew around and looked at it. That airplane was just on a pinnacle of ice way up in the air.
That was a C-47. Was that the one that crashed?
It didn't crash there, but the wind came up and broke the controls.
Oh.
And they couldn't fly the airplane, and by the time they got around to fixing it, the airplane was beyond fixing.
Yeah, I thought there was one on one of them that it bent the propeller or something. I don't know, there was something. Kenny Tuvok, he was on the, Kenny or Frankie were on the plane and told me about it, and I can't remember now.
Well, I know Zimmerman mm-hmm. had Max Brewer, and I think he had John Schindler too. And they had gone to Arliss 1. This is just, a few weeks after we went out there, when Zimmerman got back with the DC, with the C-40, the R-4D, and it was on wheel skis, and they went out there, and they spent a little time out there, and they decided that they needed to put some fuel in, so they put two drums of fuel in the right main, and the fuel that they put in was stove oil instead of avgas. And so they took off, and the right engine was running on the right main, and the temperature just started really getting hot on the cylinders, you know, because it's starting to detonate, you know. And so they shut the right engine down, and then he flew along for a while, feeding off the left main to the one engine that was going, and the airplane started to get wing heavy on the right side, so he switched tanks to the right main and burnt the right engine, and burnt the left engine up too.
Ooh.
And the engine was failing, and they came down in the light, and I was told this, that who was the co-pilot was with him? Anyway, he said, Billy Morgan. Billy Morgan was the co-pilot. Anyway, here was this big pressure ridge. They went over it, there was a field, and they stopped, and there was right in front of them was another great big pressure ridge. They just got stopped in the confines. And they got picked up the next day. And then they went back out there with the idea that a couple of 3 days later to see what they could do about getting the airplane. And the airplane was gone. The ice had opened up and the airplane had sunk.
Wow. Oh, wait, before you get up,
yeah,
in a
yeah.
second.
Okay.
Well, it sounds like those guys were really lucky.
They were very, very lucky.
I think all of that flying out there across 300 miles of ice sounds pretty risky and scary to me.
It was a tough business. Very tough.
Yeah.
There was nine of us when I went to work for Jim McGoffin in 56. And 3.5 years later, there was four of us left alive.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's just not, that's just that group. And we lost Ernie Cairns at Nome at a Twin Beach. And we lost Tommy Thompson at Twin Beach at Barter Island. And Ed Batten, you know, and Jimmy Reinhart when I was flying for Coastal.
Yeah, those days is.
Yeah.
Well, I think especially up there, you know, if you're flying over land, I don't know you have a better chance than flying over all that.
Well,
ice.
Yeah, we'd punch up on top, you know, single engine airplanes all the time and fly around on top of the clouds, and then make, you know, you had one means of navigation, a Lear ADF, but had tubes in it, you know.
What's a Lear ADF?
Automatic direction finder, but oh. it was a tube radio. It had tubes which were not near as dependable as transistors.
You know? Oh, I see. Were you ever sort of pushed to fly in marginal conditions?
Not that I didn't feel that I couldn't handle, you know. I remember going out of Kotzebue in a Pilatus Porter and going up to Kobuk, once you get up to Kiana, from there on, there's lots of vegetation on the
right.
ground. There's willows and small trees and stuff. And the weather was really crummy, and I end up picking up sick people at Kobuk and at Selawik, and landing on the river, on the ice in the river, and then Kiana. And I think I had every seat, and just about all of them went to the hospital when I got to Kotzebue, you know.
And it wasn't because of your flying.
No, it wasn't because of my flying. And Kotzebue weather was pretty crummy. But,
yeah.
But
I think Barrow was maybe worse.
Yeah, Barrow could be bad.
Yeah.
May. When ground was still white and you had all that fog.
From the open water.
Yeah. Once you got to where there was bare ground, well, then that was a little different situation.